Podcast. Welcome to the Queer Arabs Podcast. This is Alia.
And Ellie.
And we are the Queer Arabs. I'm Saudi Arabian and lesbian.
I'm not going to sing that, but okay. I am bi, trans, and Lebanese, and we live in America.
Well, hi. My name is Killian Colin. I am an LGBTQ Muslim American. I was born and raised in Iraq, and I moved here as a refugee, and now I'm a U.S. citizen.
Yes. So we are very stoked to have Killian on as our guest today. Killian's story is, you know, something everyone should hear, I think. So, Killian, can you give the listeners a little more about your background and, like, about where you grew up?
Yeah, sure. So I was born and raised in Iraq, and I'm not going to tell you which year, so because I don't want to... to know how old I am.
Oh my God.
I was born in the capital in Baghdad in the Adamiya neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
It's where
you go jogging through there?
No.
it's where you know it's mostly familiar because the civil violence and started there in that area. So mm-hmm. I kind of witnessed most of the things that was, you know, happening before moving out of Iraq in 2005. Mm-hmm. My father started a job after the war with the U.S. military. Because of his job, you know, the anti-American militias did not like that. So they actually kidnapped him. And they asked us to pay a ransom mm-hmm. in order for him to be released. And also one of the conditions after they release him free is we leave Iraq, or at least the neighborhood we're living at. We just sold out everything we own, actually, even including our clothes, our furnitures. We borrowed money from relatives, and we fled Iraq to Syria. And mm-hmm. believe it or not, when we left Iraq, we only have like $400 or $500 in our pocket. We just took the bus randomly all the way to Aleppo City in Syria. We started our journeys as refugees all the way until 2011 when we moved to the U.S.
What was the journey like? Was it difficult exiting Iraq? Were there checkpoints and stuff like that?
Technically, you know, the regular travel should take about 14 hours. It took us 2 days to reach Aleppo.
Gosh.
Yeah, it took us 2 days to reach Aleppo, just because there was a lot of checkpoints from Baghdad all the way to the Iraqi-Syrian border.
Mm-hmm.
And also on the border, we were stopped for very, very long because there was so many refugees living in Iraq. And of course, you know, there's only so many people working on this border on both sides, the Iraqi side and the Syrian side. And also, you know, this area is known in its corruption. So basically, they give you such a hard time and they detain you for long, long, long hours. So, you know, you have to pay them.
which is
almost a legal bribe because it's so obvious, you know, it's mm-hmm. there's no consequences, so it's become part of the culture. I don't know, I don't want to say legal because technically there's no law allowing them to do that, but it became part of the culture.
But there's no one prosecuting them if they do that.
It's almost expected. Like whenever my folks used to travel through Syria, or when they were in the unrest was going on in Lebanon, they had to flee through Syria. Bribes did not only happen at the border crossing; they were kind of expected.
Was very expected. Yeah, I totally agree. And and you know, the 6 years that we lived there, we have to do this journey every 3 months for 6 years because mm-hmm. we were only allowed to stay for our refugees visa for 3 months. Every 3 months we take all our stuff and, you know, we go all the way from Aleppo City to the border and we kind of check in and check out the Iraqi-Syrian borders. And then we come back to Aleppo City. From Aleppo City to the Iraqi borders, it's about 14-hour trip by bus. So we take the bus all the way from Aleppo City to Kamishli City and on the border.
Mm-hmm.
Then we take another transportation there to the border, because like an hour away.
Wow, I had no idea there was that 3 month limit. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, because there was a million Iraqis overnight that showed up at this you know, in the Syrian cities because of the war.
Right.
So they were just trying to get rid of us. You know, they were kind enough to let us in for all that time. You know, while our country was burning. But in general, you know, this is the struggle we have to go through.
Right.
And you know, traveling by bus is not cheap. Exiting and coming in through the border is not cheap either because of the bribes that you have to pay.
Right.
And you know, Iraqi borders, like the Iraqi officers, they treat us like slaves. You know, they call you names, they call you traitors because you don't live. You know, you are kind of refugee from outside Iraq. They let you like stand in the sun for hours, literally hours. Like your skin is started to burn, you know, from just standing under the sun for in lines for hours. And when you go to the check-in window, it's literally just a stamp, like check-in stamp, and there is another window for check-out.
So they take that long. Yeah,
it should not. They were just doing that, you know, to humiliate you. And unfortunately, that happened while the U.S. soldiers were just watching us. So one time I remember I spoke to the one of the American soldiers. I told him like, because I speak English, you know, so I told him, why are they doing that to us? And you guys supposed to be watching, you know, you're supposed to be helping. He said, oh, this is your, you know, this is internal issue. We don't get involved in it. Yeah, we are here just.
So what
just
were
for sick.
Yeah, I was wondering, I'm like, why are the U.S. soldiers there at that point then?
They said to stop terrorism. So, that soldier did not elaborate further. So, I mean, whatever.
Yeah. It's like, so why are you standing here then, you know, to the U.S. soldiers, why are you even standing at this very spot if you're just going to stand there?
Because he's being paid to.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like an expensive bus ride, and it sounds like it was risky every time.
It was risky pretty much, and because we were going through the vetting process, so we couldn't actually just, you know, we couldn't just cross the border and go all the way to the city, because, you know, every few months you have an interview with the UNHCR or the IOM, and then the Department of Homeland Security, finally, they check your passport, they see how long you stayed outside the country, and if they see that you stayed, like, more than just that 24-hour, like, check-in period, they will start questioning you, and they might remove you from the resettlement program. So you cannot just go all the way to Baghdad or to Mosul, whatever city that you came from.
Yeah.
You kind of have to stay... just to do that check-in process and go back, you know, and it is really hard, specifically for people who has children, who has disabilities, elderly people. It's such a tough journey, you know, and some people, they can't even walk because there is a walking distance. There's like a mile between the two check-in, you know, gates, like the Iraqi and the Syrian border. There is like a mile in between. I'm just assuming it's a mile. I never measured this, so just to be clear.
But it felt like you probably got a sense of about how far it was.
You walk really for a long distance, you know. And it was easy for me because I was young, you know, and reckless. But for many people who are disabled, who are elderly, it was a really hard journey. But that's the only way that you could protect yourself from being prosecuted by the private militias and ISIS, whatever forces on the ground that, you know, that is
whoever was occupying
security. Exactly. Yeah, that you know, Iraq after the invasion, it was very complicated. You know, it was a really complicated issue because every single city have different militias, have different agendas, have different targets. So you can't really blame it on one part and not the other part because they were all participating in that. I call it a genocide, you know. Since the results was more than a million Iraqi that died after the invasion.
That's the definition.
Yeah, and it keep happening until now. Actually, my two of my uncles and one aunt just got liberated from ISIS in Mosul City. They lived for many years under the occupation of ISIS. So it's just keep on happening. And they were, I told them like, yeah, congratulations. I was like, yeah, don't congratulate us, because sooner or later another militia will control the city and we will just go back to the zero point. So it's a mess.
So they're still in Mosul.
They are still in Mosul. Oh, and
and they're just like, okay, we're waiting for whatever's next. Like, yeah.
They are, and you know, every single, you know, war that they go through, that will eliminate the number of jobs that they have, the amount of resources that they have. It will just make their life harder, you know. When there is a big destruction to the infrastructure in that city, it is so hard for educated people, for example, to find jobs, like teachers, professors, doctors. Maybe it's good for people who doesn't have skills, you know, because they could participate in rebuilding the city. But other people who have professional degrees, they couldn't find jobs easily. So most of them were forced to migrate to different cities or just leave the country and become refugees in neighbor countries. So that's why Iraq is still actually producing refugees and immigrants, even though it's kind of calmed down now in terms of national security.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
So as for you, you mentioned the IOM, you know, dealing with UNHCR, dealing with IOM, dealing with DHS. So it's a lot of components.
Wait, you know? DHS? Was this the Iraq DHS, Syrian DHS, or
No, the U.S. Department, U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Yeah. And the IOM is the International Organization of Migration. UNHCR is the United Nations Higher Commissioner for Refugees. Sorry, I should have elaborated that earlier.
Yeah, so there are like these three layers.
That people have
like three interviews, right?
It's not interview only. So this is the thing, like when people talk about extreme betting.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's like, true.
Extreme betting. I mean, like, right. How extreme you want that betting to be?
Right. You like, what more can they do?
I think with this administration, extreme betting means so extreme you don't want to bother.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is I totally agree with you, Aliyah. You know, so in order for you to become a refugee, you have to go and sign up for the UNHCR. After like a long waiting period, you have your first interview, and then after you interview them, you have to provide them with the evidence that you were prosecuted, etc., etc. Your file will go through something called the resettlement department. And they study your case, and they see that you are actually eligible to be resettled into a third country, they will call you for a second interview. And then for another interview with the UNHCR before they decided actually to refer your file to the IOM. Then the IOM will do at least three interviews with you individually and with your family. And after the IOM vet you very well, they will... and vet the evidence that you give them, they will transfer. They will put you on the waiting list to see the Department of Homeland Security. Then you will go through 2, 3, 4 interviews with the Department of Homeland Security and universal background check, etc., etc. So the process is really, really long. It takes years and years. It took us 6 years, you know, before we come to the U.S.
Oh my God.
And you know, every single interview, they will try to ask you question about your previous interview, and they will compare your answers, and if they see any difference between your answer, that means there's some lies or something going on wrong, they will deny you the whole process. So you have to be as honest as possible, and hopefully you have a good memory, so you don't forget, because you know, if you forget things, it will give the impression that you might be lying. A lot of people, you know, I know they were extremely vulnerable, but you know, they didn't have a good memory to remember everything.
Human being does, you know,
specifically us, you know, as refugees, we've been through too much trauma in our lives. You know, some of us were kidnapped, some of us were tortured, some of us lost their beloved one in the war. So you know, when you go through these kind of traumas and PTSDs, your memory started to evaporate as a way to grieve like, or
like a defense mechanism.
It is. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I myself actually, you know, try to forget a lot of things before, you know, but just keep on going, coming back and forth, and until I accepted them as part of my history, and I accepted the reality that, that I'm actually fine and safe now.
Yeah.
So.
Oh wow.
So yeah, you know, the vetting process is already extreme, is already inhuman. That's what I call it.
Mm-hmm.
And I promise myself, any politician who support this extreme vetting process will not get my vote or support here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And today is my first time voting in the primaries since I became a
citizen. Congratulations!
Thank
That's
you.
Huge.
Thank you. Yeah,
oh,
so
that must have felt really, really meaningful.
It is actually very meaningful, and I wrote a post about it on Facebook. I was like, yesterday
I actually
we were
saw
just...
it. I was so excited. I was so excited.
Yeah, I was like, I mean, like yesterday we were just refugees who are seeking asylum, and today we are part of decision making. And voting actually is one of the most important part that you not only ensure your overall, you know, welfare, but the welfare of other people also, like future refugees, our future generations. This is all will depend on who you are voting for today.
This is a reminder to our listeners. Everyone needs to vote if you can.
Vote primary, vote main election, vote off year, and then, you know, yell at them whenever they fuck up.
Yes. Any U.S. citizen listening, like, do not take voting for granted. This is a really good reminder.
And even if you are not a U.S. citizen, actually, if you are a permanent resident, you can actually contribute money to campaigns.
True. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I did contribute to in the 2016 election. I'm not gonna tell you to who, but but I did actually contribute because I felt that Trump was super dangerous to people like me, and to to any vulnerable class in our society. Trump is very dangerous to them, so that's why I did contribute to the both nominees for the Democratic Party, although I consider myself more independent, but you know, we didn't have much choices in 2016.
You know, someday we'll even have a leftist running.
Yeah.
Someday.
Exactly. So So do your part as you know, do your part in the political process. Nobody can stop you from talking to neighbors, from canvassing, volunteering to political campaigns, contributing.
Yeah.
So use any power you have, because this is your civil defense mechanism to protect yourself and the next generation. And if you choose not to participate, I would consider that a shame, actually. Because that's mean you're not doing your part as a good citizen. When you come to a democratic country, you must put all your power and energy to try to make a change. So this is at least my opinion. I hope people won't get offended by it.
No, I think it's really important. Also, I'm so glad you brought up the good point that permanent residence can make a huge difference too. It's not just voting that causes change, or that, you know.
I think about 35% of the adults in the U.S. are permanent residents, if I'm not mistaken. I have to double check my data. So this is a big number, and these people are taxpayers, actually. You know, so when the government increase your taxes, it will affect you. When the government remove programs like the ACA, it will affect them eventually.
Yeah.
When the government start persecuting or start discriminating against LGBTQ people, it will affect them. So any decision the government is making, it will affect them. So why not be part of the solution?
Yeah, it's a power and a privilege that we all have, and so we shouldn't take it for granted. So
I would consider that a duty, not a privilege. You know, it's our
that's
duty.
Good point. Yeah, even more. I mean, yeah, even take it a step further.
Exactly. I mean, like, I will talk about my resistance back in the Middle East in a few minutes. And if I was able to defend myself and resist in the Middle East in the middle of dictatorships and civil wars, you can do that here when you're actually saved from being prosecuted and right. you know, saved from being killed for expressing your opinion. So and I'm just a simple person, very very average simple person, you know, and also very vulnerable. So right. so don't take anything for granted.
Right, like. We all have the power to do good. Can you give the listeners some information about what you did in the Middle East?
Well, the question is, where should I start?
Yeah. I know I gave a broad question. But...
So,
what were you doing when the war started? Let's start at the sort of. The whole, what got this whole refugee ball rolling?
So, you know, I was born in a wartime, you know, in a war zone. I was born when the Iraqi-Iranian war was almost wrapping up, but it didn't finish yet. Now you can figure out.
Now you all can.
When I was born, actually, my father was not around because he was sent to the war, you know, with Iran, such a shameful war for 8 years that drained the resources of two countries and killed tons of civilians, unfortunately, for because of two dictatorships were fighting each other's ideologies. Mm-hmm. So you know, before my father actually left to the war, he told my mom that if she doesn't hear from him back, call my son Khalid, and if it's a female, call her Khalida. And it means you know, internal or like live forever. So that was true. My mom did not hear from my dad for 2 months, and I was born, so she called me Khalid or Khalid. After I think I was 60 days old when my father actually showed up, and after he showed up, they sent him to another war again, you know, in the north of Iraq, because Kurdistan wanted to separate from Iraq at this time, and they sent my dad again to another stupid war, and my dad was working, was a painter, so they used him to write, to do paperwork. He never actually carried a weapon, which is something he was blessed, because, you know, my dad cannot even kill a fly or he doesn't even step on roaches. So he imagined. So he was blessed enough not to carry a weapon during that war. But it's still, I mean, just him being away from home in the most important part in his life, you know, when my mom was giving birth to his first child, he missed that moment. And, you know, how wow. It's such an important moment for every parent to be around.
Of course.
Anyway, I actually started, you know, I my memory goes back when I was a few years old. And it was, I think, it was during the Clinton era, or maybe the Jewish Bush era, when the second war started, the U.S., whatever they call that war, the Gulf War. Yeah. So this is where the snapshot goes, like, in my memory back to that era. There was always no power, electricity, because it was bombed by the U.S. airstrikes. I remember the bombing sounds. I remember, like, going to a shelter, then leaving the shelter after the U.S. targeted the Amaria shelter, Baghdad. So these are the simple memories that I have from the first war. But then just war kept coming, you know, throughout the history, you know, when I was growing up in Iraq. When Bill Clinton was accused of sexual harassment, he bombed Baghdad. You know, I was already in elementary school. He airstrike Baghdad for 3 days. When, you know, George W. Bush came, he wanted to clean his father's mess. He invaded Iraq in 2003. And then after 2003, the civil war started. And then when I moved to Syria, another civil war started. So it's like, okay.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we got Trump. So.
Oh, God. You're just like, can I just get a break?
I know. Yeah. Well, you know, but again, I appreciated going through that in my life. It was a big lesson for me. You know, you've seen a lot of things in wars make you just stronger. If it doesn't mm-hmm. crash you or kill you or disable you, it make you actually a very, very strong person. Yeah. And I believe those wars that I went through in my life made me a much stronger person that I am today. It made me appreciate the value of peace. It made me an activist against wars. So I believe it taught me a big lesson. It's like getting a PhD in wars or peacemaking.
That's a very, yeah. Honestly, I mean, that's just a very admirable attitude. So when you say activism, does that include anywhere in the Middle East, or did you start being an activist once you got to the US?
No, actually, I started when I was in Syria. You know, I started exploring my sexuality more in Syria than it was in Iraq. In Iraq, I was just a schoolboy, you know, yeah. trying to just go to school then back home because, you know, it was really dangerous to be in the street or hang out around. I'm not saying I did not explore a little bit of my sexuality there, but I was in a big denial also. I did not accept my reality until we actually moved to Syria. And I was in my junior high school, and I was able to leave actually house and go explore the city on my own.
Mm-hmm.
This was the first time that I felt liberated. And there is a public park in the middle of Aleppo city called the public park. Mm-hmm. That's when people goes there and they spend like all their night there. Aleppo is a night city, it's not a day city.
Yeah.
So it's perfectly safe. People goes there, families with their children, everybody. So I was hanging out there at night, and then people like men were starting to say hi to me and sit next to me and start yeah. a chit chat with me, specifically that I have a different accent or dialogue than the Syrian people.
Yeah.
And then I figured out actually that was the place where LGBTQ people meet.
Oh.
And in the city.
Yeah.
That was the offline grinder for LGBTQ.
Right. Old school. Keeping it old school.
Yeah, I mean, internet yeah. was, you know, was a privilege for only a few people at that time, you know. So it wasn't much available like now. So right. that's where you go there and you meet people, and you either do it in the park or you do it in a private place. That will depend.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, that was actually, you know, a big change. That made a big change in my life, because now I don't feel the same feelings of regret after you finish the hookup. You don't have that prejudice against others because you're meeting different people, different ages, different maybe races, different colors. It was like a life experience for me. It was pretty, pretty slutty, to be honest with you, but
hey,
it was also liberating for me.
I feel like it was a really important time of your life to discover, like, you know, make that discovery.
Discover my own sexuality. Mm-hmm. But it was still immature, you know. It was all about sex at that time, until I actually started networking with people, start making friends.
Mm-hmm.
We were meeting just to talk and chit chat instead of meeting for sexual interactions.
Yeah, because we all need some sort of community where we can be honest and open. You know, it can't just be about the sex.
Exactly, and that's when I actually started building my personality. I kind of satisfied the sexual part that was oppressed for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
But then I got tired of it also. I needed something else. I needed a community.
Yeah.
And this is where my activism started. This is when we refused to hide in the park anymore. We started to go out in the street and hold hands.
Wow.
It helped us. It helped us a little bit because, you know, the Middle Eastern society is more masculine society, so it's normal for men to hold hands.
Right.
However, our you know, we were holding hands in more lovely way.
Right.
And people were seeing us and realizing us, but also not giving us a dirty looks. Not some of them did, you know, not actually retaliate against us. They were kind of more accepting than what I've seen in the Iraqi society.
Wow.
We started actually like doing parties on our own. We started talking to some public officials who are also LGBTQ, but in the closet, who also protected us in that area, because we were constantly stopped by police and searched by police. And also sometimes they take advantage of us. They steal our money. They steal our cell phones. Because we can't go and sue them. There's no human rights watch. And also homosexuality is punishable by 9-month imprisonment in Syria. So you can't actually go legally and challenge them.
Otherwise, you just get charged with whatever the code of homosexuality is under.
Yeah, you could go to jail for 9 months. Yeah. And it's a big scandal, you know, if you go to jail for something like that. So that struggle was real, but also we were resisting that. We were talking back actually to the police. We were threatening them that we're going to call their boss, for example. We know the name. And we did sometimes. So that was kind of the beginning of our resistance. Then I actually decided to come out and talk about it to the people. So I started talking to my friends. I lost some of them after I actually came out to them. I started talking to the youth groups that they were doing like political organizing.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, when the civil war started in the south of Syria, the Syrian regime kind of gave the youth organizations more ability to move around. So he kind of, because he doesn't want them to rebel against him, against Al-Assad. So he kind of gave these private organizations to be more publicly able to be, to put their view more publicly without being prosecuted. Mm-hmm. So that was a good, you know, that was a good thing for us to actually come out to the surface and start telling people about our sexuality. However, that honeymoon didn't last for very long, because the civil war started jumping from one city to another. Mm-hmm. Extremist groups starting actually becoming more stronger. And who do you think extremist group will come after first? They will come after the LGBTQ people and the women, because we are the most vulnerable in the society.
Yeah.
So one and day, actually,
sorry, I was going to say that, that the Syrian government and Al-Assad giving youth groups, like who may be gay or pro-Western in any way, extra space to speak out and be on the record for those things would actually kind of lock them into being, if not pro-Al-Assad, at least not able to hook up with the resistance in any meaningful way, because they've got that black mark against them now, that they said, hey, we're one of those people who are not acceptable to this rebel group.
So correct.
That was pretty cynical of them.
That's totally correct, actually. And that's why we were coming to the surface, you know. I mean, I wasn't pro-Assad by any means, actually. I have a big mouth. I always talk about, you know, about him, how he persecuted people and everything.
Yeah.
Which was very dangerous at that time. But
It's imputed, or it's...
Yeah,
that's,
I mean, I should give him the credit, you know, for me coming out to the surface and start talking to people about it and not being shy about it, not being shy about holding hands public, not being shy of having actually a partner. It's by no means similar to the way Western LGBTQ people come out to the public. It's not that. It's not even close, but it was something in a very, very conservative Muslim majority society. It was a big steps also, although it looks too small comparing to the coming out in the Western world.
Well, to be fair, the whole idea of coming out was, so originally, it was a huge deal in America, like in the 50s and early 60s, because at that point, you could be in prison and people could you know, unofficially lynch or kill you in many places without retaliation. The idea behind coming out in America was so that people could see that homosexuals are regular people, they're not criminals, they're not, you know, child molesters or dangerous people, they're just regular folks who just love a little differently. And the idea behind coming out was a very much political statement where it says, yes, I am this person. Yes, I am your family, your friend, your neighbor, your son, your daughter, your mother, your father, whatever. And, you know, after, at this point, what, 50 years plus of that, you know, yes, it's legal for us to marry in the United States, but there's still a lot of pushback, you know.
So it's not that
dissimilar from the American experience with the whole coming out as a political statement.
I totally agree with you. I mean, I consider me coming, my experience of coming out late 2010 and early 2011, similar before the Stonewall era.
Yeah.
Or during the Stonewall. That's how I compare my coming out experiment, because, you know, again, you could be in prison for being LGBTQ, openly LGBTQ. You could be vulnerable for the honor killing, which is totally legal in Iraq and Syria. Mm-hmm. These are pretty serious consequences, actually, if you wanted to come out to the public.
Right.
And we've seen actually honor killing in the ISIS held territories. We've seen gay people being thrown out of the wall, you know, of the trove and being stoned to death. We've seen these ugly pictures coming from the Middle East. Although they were not, you know, it wasn't something that is widely spread, and thanks God ISIS was a very, very temporary thing, but it did happen. When I see those pictures, I feel how privileged I am to actually keep myself to be alive today. That's how much I thanks my God, you know, and I pray to God that you know, God gave me actually a second chance that was not available for other people like myself, who decided to come out to the surface.
And that's why I decided I will
always use my voice as a privileged person now to defend those who are underprivileged. I'm an activist in San Diego County on a daily basis. On social media or on the ground protesting or holding events,
talking on podcasts.
Exactly, talking about broadcast. And trust me, even though I'm out, it's not that easy. There's still a lot of rejection from the Muslim community, for example, in my area, and from some other people as well.
What kind of resistance have you gotten from the Muslim community in the United States? If you want to talk about it.
I don't mind talking about it. So my intention was to bring more awareness to the Muslim community about the LGBTQ Muslim. This is my goal. Is I don't want to see any child go through what I went through in my childhood. I don't want children to, because imagine growing up in an Orthodox household.
Yeah.
While you are LGBT, but you cannot express it, or if you express it, you will be abused by your parents or by your relatives. These things I am 100% sure it's happening now in the US within our community. You know, if it's happening in the evangelical families, it's also happening in the Muslim families.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to involve the leaders of the Muslim community in San Diego, but unfortunately I was not lucky. I went from a mosque to mosque talking to imams, and they all rejected actually to talk about it publicly. Actually, one of them told me that, we do not accept homosexuality. I was like, I'm not looking for acceptance, I told him. I'm looking for tolerance. I'm looking for tolerance. He said, we do not tolerate it. Our religion doesn't allow us to. I was like,
You're
your
like,
religion
show
speak.
me, in the Quran where it says that.
Exactly. And he brought
Show
in, he
me.
brought he said an ayah from Quran. I don't recall which one he used. He said that we don't you know, Quran doesn't accept something is abnormal or is not natural. I told him
like that's too
there is one
vague. That's
there is
too
168
vague.
Species that has homosexuality, and that is scientifically proven. You know, you have
How
the birds, you have
yeah.
the monkeys, you have every single animals, you know, have homosexuality in them.
Yeah.
How is homosexuality something not
natural?
Real?
Yeah,
not natural. You know, and
right.
also a lot of animals, they change their gender too. You know, so you know, this is
right.
part of your nature.
Yeah.
Being a transgender person, being LGBTQ person, being homosexual, this is part of nature. You know, we are
so
God
true.
Does not make mistakes. Actually, just that's the reality that you're saying that we are a mistake. You're insulting Allah, you know, you're insulting God, the greatest creature.
Right.
How can you worship a God that is not perfect?
Yeah. And so many religious leaders or whoever, like they will point to like different hadiths, and people forget that these hadiths
are tradition.
Opinions. They are opinions.
Yeah. It was, you know,
Should,
and it's
yeah.
could it could be easily rewritten by people, just like the Bible. The you know, a hadith was very vulnerable for translation, for being rewritten according to people. Well, you know, we had too many dictatorships in the Muslims' empires throughout the history, and each dictatorship comes with his own imams and his own, you know, scientists and his own philosophers, and they
yeah.
all added to the Sharia law. They all added to the Hadith. They thanks God they couldn't play with Quran. That will be a disaster.
Right, exactly. And if you try to point back to the Quran, then people will make all kinds of excuses about.
Show me
yeah.
one ayah that condemn homosexuality.
Exactly.
In Quran.
We challenge anyone.
By the way, for a more extended discussion of this, please refer back to our May 11th episode, where we do talk with a women's imam.
Yes, yeah. So we're recording this the night before
it comes out.
It comes out, yeah. And a female imam who it talks a lot about this too. So
so if you haven't listened
this really
to the
ties
back episodes,
together.
You know,
yeah.
listen to the May 11th for a deeper and longer discussion on this.
Yeah.
I will do that. I'm so excited actually to listen to her and see what her opinion about this issue.
Yeah.
Because you know, I mean I'm not so religious, but I pray five times a day. I pay my zakat when I have to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I say shahada every single morning. So technically I consider myself a devoted Muslim, you know,
yeah,
even though I'm not perfect, I don't do everything, you know. It's too hot I live in San Diego, and too many people, you know, we are very close to the beach, so it's so hard to be fasting Ramadan with all the hot
guys around, right?
Oh my god.
That's my excuse to break fast. Well, I'm just kidding, by the way, but anyway.
I love it. No, I mean, I think it's important, like, I think it's important for people to remember, you know, devoted Muslims, it's so, that can be so many things. It's so diverse, and like a huge part of Islam is justice and humanity, and it's that should be at the core.
Speaking from the atheist side of
things, in my
opinion, is everyone does need a community, you know, somewhat connected to their lives and their traditions. Yeah, it's not, and for like, you know, LGBTQ types like us, you know, we're not going to find like, we're not always going to have our family or other traditional avenues, but you know, we still crave that. You know, we still want that companionship, even like in community, you know, someone to fall back on, even if it isn't, you know, the usual extended family that we've been raised to sort of expect to be on our sides, and often is not.
I totally agree. I mean, this is our basic human right, you know, to be able to
be. I wouldn't call
be...
it right. I would just call it almost like our. Like,
no, it's our human right. It's our right to be respected for who we are.
Well, I was
going to
say,
know?
Like the community we create isn't just a right; it is a necessity for us.
It's just a necessity, exactly. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. I totally agree.
And
I mean,
for a person to deny it to themselves or be denied that sort of community is just extremely cruel.
It is totally. I mean, come back to the origin of Islam. Come back to when Islam started. Who first believed in Islam? It was women and slaves, the most vulnerable class in the Quraysh society. Mm. You know, it was the wife of Muhammad Khadija. It was Bilal Habashi. He was a slave. You know, those were the first two people to believe in Muhammad's message. Because why did they believe? True. They believed because they were being persecuted later. No, they believed because Islam came to liberate them, to bring them justice, to empower them. Mm-hmm. Exactly, brought them hope, and it did. You know, Bilal Habashi became a leader of the nation. You know, somehow. I mean, the Adhan that we are listening to five times a day, that was written by Bilal Habashi. He was an Ethiopian slave within the Quraysh society, you know.
Yeah.
So go back to the real spirit of Islam. Why the Islam that we see today is not similar to the Islam that Muhammad brought to people? You know, this is the question. This is how I actually argue with these religious leaders in San Diego County. But unfortunately, you know, I was not that lucky. And even CARE San Diego, the counseling Muslim, whatever they call it, it's an nonprofit organization that advocate for Muslims' right in the community. Yeah.
Deeper and longer discussion on CARE and other such groups, May 11th episode. It's really awesome.
Oh yeah, yeah. This is all tying together so well.
Did they do an episode with you? I'm surprised.
No, not them. We talked about them last.
Yeah, yes. I call them care, don't care. So yeah, that's how I call them. I mean, you know, what upset me is they held a lot of events in San Diego County. Uh-huh. They actually gave awards to some LGBTQ candidates and activists, but none of them is Muslim. You know, none of them is Muslim.
No, they acknowledge
They acknowledged them. They gave them awards. They thanked them. They took pictures with them. Put them on their social media. Yeah. And when I came and speak to them, they totally ignored me. And actually, I was attacked by one of their members on Facebook for speaking out against CARE, for writing articles about CARE. Wow. Why CARE is not paying attention to the LGBTQ Muslim. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, I am an average citizen, but I'm also a big activist in the community. I am a labor activist on the national and international level. I was the first Muslim American to testify in front of the parliament in Australia. I represented the American bank workers in Australia and spoke in front of them. Mm-hmm. I represented the American bank workers in Washington D.C. and spoke in front of the Senate. I think I jumped ahead of the train, but yeah. I am the first whistleblower. I'm one of the first whistleblowers that blow the whistle about the Wells Fargo scandal. I used to work at Wells Fargo, and I witnessed their shady activities. So I was one of the first people who actually started talking to the public about the Wells Fargo scandal.
We were just talking about this yesterday, Ellie and me. So yeah. This is interesting.
Yeah, we've been,
as they say in Baghdad, I'm a bin halal, you know.
Oh my God, you are a troublemaker in the best way.
I am a troublemaker.
I love it.
You know, I think that's the way I grew up. You know, my parents were artists. They were painters. They were showing their disagreement with the society around them by painting pictures. My dad painted like naked people, for example. Yeah. He used that nudity in his art, which is something rejected by the Muslim society, you know. Yeah. But he used it in his art, and he started selling his art to people as a way to rebel against the institution. My mom, for example, my mom never wore hijab in Baghdad, although it was really dangerous for her. She was blamed by her family. She was blamed by the neighbors. She was blamed by everybody else. But she like changed her hair color and you know air dry her hair. Yeah, yeah. And she put the makeup on and she goes to work.
Good for her. Wow.
And that was actually a big thing.
That's a huge deal.
It's a huge deal. I mean, I mean, it's not like illegal to go without hijab, like in Iran, you know. It was perfectly legal, but it wasn't accepted by the society.
Maybe officially it was legal, but unofficially
it was frowned.
It's forbidden actually by the society standards. Right. You know, my mom always hear these bad words being called when we were working. I was little boy, and I walk with her to the market, and everybody's telling her, like, oh, this is haram, or oh my God, didn't you have a parents to teach you? And sometimes she get angry and fight with them, with the toughest. Well, they think they're the toughest. They look like the toughest man, big guys, you know. And she doesn't care. She just stand up and she yell on them. She let them in the front of, you know, everybody else. So I got this personality, the troublemaker personality from my parents.
I love it. I want to be friends with your mom.
Thank you.
She sounds amazing. She sounds like such a badass. I love it. Yeah, you all are.
Bring her to Texas. Yeah. We will cook dinner for you.
Let me visit Texas first. I only been to Dallas before, so let me come visit you guys first.
Oh yeah, come further south. Come to Houston.
I will. I promise.
This
troublemaker personality. Didn't just happen overnight. It was taught by my parents, by the environment around me. And, you know, growing up as an LGBTQ person, I have no way to live but to fight back for my own rights. You know, I'm either crushed by society or I fight back for my own rights. You know, you can't win every war, but every loss that I made or I got, it was a learning experience for me.
You learned something. Yeah.
I learned something. I learned a lot, thanks God, you know, from my resistant experiment as an LGBTQ child and a teenager and now.
Yeah.
So that's why, yeah, like, wow. I started working at Wells Fargo back in 2013, and I moved from social work, from a social worker with refugees to actually a personal banker at the retail store Wells Fargo Bank. And I witnessed everything that was being said on the news, you know, from employees opening fake accounts to their customers, applying for credit cards on their behalf, applying for loans on their behalf, screwing people credits. That was happening on daily basis. It was pretty normal, you know. We were getting instructions from the management, from everybody else, that was, this is okay. I mean, yes, the official language of the company says this is unethical, but when the CEO of Wells Fargo, John Stump, says that we need every single customer to have at least six products from Wells Fargo, how do you expect an average citizen to have six products with one bank, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why, like, you come to the bank, you just want a simple saving account, you ended up having a checking account, saving account, a credit card, a debit card, whatever, online banking, and trust me, the customer doesn't even know about them.
I'm very glad I've closed out my accounts with
me
them.
Me too.
You've done the right thing. You know, I've seen a lot of people coming back to me, you know, their credit history is being damaged, their house being foreclosed on. It's sad stories that, you know, I swear to God, I'm a very, very tough person, but every night I came back from Wells Fargo, I cry. For 3 years that I spent Wells Fargo, I cry every single night. Because I can't see people being frightened in front of my face, and I have no choice but to smile on their face and tell them or something like that. I was part of this shitty business, you know. I was part of this scandal, and I just couldn't.
You spoke up, and that's.
Well, I didn't speak up immediately. And that added a huge toll on my life. I was being extremely depressed. Actually, I went through a clinical depression. I was taking sleeping medication because I could not sleep at night. I wasn't eating because, you know, I started my day 8:45 in the morning, and then I have customers constantly sitting on my desk all whole day. Yeah. So I was missing my lunch break. I was missing my 15 minutes break. I wasn't eating. My job is done at 6 o'clock, but, you know, usually I am sitting in the branch until like almost 7 o'clock because I have customers sitting on my desk. And usually after work, I go to school immediately. I'm a full-time student, so I don't go back home until like almost 11 to 12. So I just go to sleep, and throughout the day, actually I don't go to sleep, I take that back, because throughout the day I'm just drinking coffee on my desk, I'm not eating. So I'm starting actually losing weight. I lost 45 pounds within
45, you said?
Within 45 pounds within less than a year.
Oh no.
Because wow. I slowly starting losing my appetite, and that was adding to my depression. And one night I wasn't able to sleep, even though I took sleeping pills. So I decided to take the whole set of my sleeping pills. I decided, like, you know what? I'm just so tired. I'm not gonna live that anymore.
Yeah.
I gave up. That was a big wake up call for me. You know, that suicidal attempt was a big, big, big wake up call for me. Because when I woke up, I figured out that, you know what? I am so blessed to have a second chance in this life. Actually, I would call it a fourth chance in my life, because, you know, I've been through civil wars before.
True. Yeah.
And maybe I woke up because I have a message to deliver. Maybe I woke up because I should be a whistleblower. I don't know. I'm just gonna try it.
Wow.
And it happened. You know, I started as just a crazy whiny little bitch complaining about my work.
To
an international activist in the labor movement. We established something called the Committee for Better Banks under the CWA umbrella. I personally delivered the first petition that was signed by 13,000 people to the Wells Fargo headquarters in Minneapolis. We were chasing Wells Fargo headquarters from one city to one city to another city to from one state to another state. And we were lobbying the city attorney of Los Angeles and the Senate in Washington, D.C. And finally, the city attorney of Los Angeles filed a lawsuit against Wells Fargo, and Wells Fargo settled $150 million, something like that. And then it was, after that settlement, it was fined by the CFPB in Washington, D.C., another $100 million. And then, you know, lawsuits kept coming, and, you know, the company was going down. Then John Stump stepped down from his position and paid back $40 million from his own bonuses. And we're still pressuring. I'm still part of the movement. I'm still an activist. We grow so big now. We are the biggest national frontline bank workers committee. We're not a union yet. We're trying.
Yeah.
We were able to unionize Santa Deer Bank workers in Texas. Actually, that's why I went. That's why
really?
I went to Dallas.
Oh, that's why. Oh, okay.
That's why I went to Dallas.
Good reason.
Yeah.
Was able to start a union in fucking Texas.
Actually, don't underestimate the workers in Texas. They are the most badass workers in the country. In the middle of, you know, Texas has the right to work law, so it's one of the hardest places actually to establish a union. But
For people, right to work means that your employer in Texas has the right to fire you at will, and they don't have to give a reason, and it's legal so long as they don't give an illegal reason.
Exactly. So that actually gave a reason to workers to stand up and fight back. And I'm so proud of the workers in Santa Deer Bank in Texas specifically, because they started that union, and we are very close to sign the neutrality agreement with Santa Deer Bank. They're still pushing back and forth. But, you know, if Miss Peggy is listening now, she is one of the leaders in Santa Deer Bank. I'm so proud of you, Miss Peggy. And I love you so much. You know, she knows how much I love her. She's one of the leaders in Santa Deer Bank. You know, it's amazing. It's
incredible.
Amazing. It's amazing how much work they've done. And also we were able to unionize Bank of Brazil as well. And we're moving slowly from bank to bank. Unfortunately, we were not able to to unionize Wells Fargo workers yet, because Wells Fargo keep on firing people. So that's our target, you know, to unionize all bank workers in the country.
Amazing.
Because unions is what made America great in the first place. Unions is what created the middle class in the country. Unions it's why we are enjoying the minimum wages privilege today. So all of these things that was established because of unions. You may call me a crazy socialist person, but it's the reality, you know. Laborers are the one who build a country. You cannot build a civilized country off the shoulders of slavery. And if you are being underpaid, if you are working without benefits, without something that will keep your dignity, you are a slave technically. So we refuse to be slaves to our employees anymore, and that's why we stand back and fight.
Wow. Oh. You're awesome.
I am not awesome. I'm just crazy.
You're crazy awesome.
Thank you.
I love that you've grown to have, I mean, of course you're human. You're still going to have fears and everything, but it's just like you act despite whatever fear is there. And
it's my only way to be able to survive, just to fight back.
Yeah.
It's just so happened that I was in the place that made me an activist. You know, it's just so happened that I was LGBTQ, that I have to fight back, you know, to stay alive. Going back to Syria, actually, I was beaten up almost to death because of my identity. That happened a few months before we left Syria to the US. You know, somebody just made, you know, tricked me to go with him to a private place, you know, when I went with him to that private place, it was a trick. It was actually set up, and they were part of the, like, I don't know if they were a militia, I don't know if they were part of the government. They said they were part of the government militias, but I had no way. So, you know, I was actually beaten up almost to death. I was sexually assaulted, and I passed out actually, and I woke up after a few hours. There was blood in my eyes, so I couldn't see anything. All I've seen is a red image of everything. I couldn't feel my body because it was completely numb, so I didn't know if I have broken bones, whatever.
Yeah.
So I start crawling out of that basement, and I start crawling to the street, and I don't remember pain because I was numb.
Mm-hmm.
I was feeling numb. I don't remember fears. I was just remember that I was embarrassed because, you know, my hair looked like a mess. I looked like a mess, and now I have to walk all the way home.
Right.
So that was, you know, the only thing was that, you know, that was uncomfortable that I felt at that moment. But
yeah.
But thinking about it, when I, you know, thinking that I couldn't actually go to the hospital because I would be deported from Syria, and then my whole vetting process will be thrown out of the window.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you are a foreigner, if you're a refugee in Syria, if you go to the emergency room, you are vulnerable for being deported because by law they have to call the immigration officers. And of course, when the immigration immigration police come to the hospital, they will ask me, why did you get beat up? Why did you go to that place? Why, who are these people? Then they will blame me as a victim. They will not blame them as oppressors. I have to live with my wounds for many months. Before we lived to the US.
Wow.
So thinking about that moment, actually, that I almost lost my life, I don't know, like, I still kind of, when I think about it, I think how blessed I am actually to stay alive, how blessed I am to survive that moment, how blessed I am that I don't have a PTSD from that incident.
Yeah, wow.
So, you know, sometimes people think that I'm exaggerating. And I just tell them, did you live in two civil wars before?
Yeah.
As an LGBTQ openly person. And they say no. Like, right, I was like, right. I was like, then shut the fuck up.
Then you have no fucking clue what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry for my French. But yeah. So.
Oh, we're all about the French here.
That is good. That's my world. So, yeah. So I hear a cat.
Oh yeah, we have two cats. Do you like cats too?
This is our co-host Cinco. She's our technical wrangler and receiver of cats.
Yeah.
I have a Snow White. She's 4 years old. I adopted her.
Oh, I saw your kitty with two different. Doesn't Snow White have different eyes too?
Yeah, one green, one blue. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, it's
so. So if you download this podcast on iTunes or any other places, if you go to our website, thequeerhabs.com, there will be cat pictures from this episode.
Yes, if Killian is willing to show his cat, we will
post it. I will. Yes. I promise.
I'm so excited. Yeah, I think the world needs to see this cat.
Yeah, it's no one. The first time I saw her, I did not adopt her because she looks beautiful. I adopt her because she looks so goofy and so lovely. And because, you know, I brought my, you know, we brought our cat from Styria with us when we came here to the U.S.
Wow.
Yeah, awesome. We had we had Sona before. I found her on the street when in my way to college there. I went to law school in Aleppo. So, on my way, actually, on my way back home, I apologize for that. I found her on the street. I just fell in love with her. She was like literally a little bitty, like 2 months old. She was abandoned by her mom, I think. So I took her home. You know, we gave her a shower, and she grew up with us for 3-4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when we left Syria, we decided no, she is part of the family. We're not gonna leave her behind. So we paid for her passport and immunization about $100 and then $200 ticket, airline ticket, and we brought her with us. You know, she died in an accident back in 2014, unfortunately. And then I adopted Snow White. And Sona was very aggressive. Like, she doesn't like to be touched. She's a diva. she liked to come to you and like touch you with her head, you know, but once you touch her, she will bite you or she will scratch you.
It has to be her initiative. Like,
she's the most independent cat that I ever seen in my life. So when I saw Snow, I was like, oh my gosh, you are so totally different. I love you.
Is Snow White really cuddly and affectionate?
She is. She loves to cuddle. She loves to sleep, you know, on your lap. She loves to sleep on your bed. She's everything that Sona wasn't, so.
So you're like, let me experience this other type of cat.
Yeah. And we always been cat people. Even when we were in Baghdad, we had like 13 cats. They were outdoor cats. They were in our backyard. So, like, both Sona and Snow White were indoor cats, and it's much more beautiful to have your pet with you indoor than outdoor, you know. Because they live with you, they become part of the family, unlike just part of the backyard, you know.
So that's true. They really become more domesticated. Just like very attached to you.
And she sleep a lot. I don't know why, but she sleep a lot. Snow White.
I think, isn't it like cats sleep 18 hours a day or something like that?
I would say my cats sleep 23 hours a day.
23 hours. What a calm life to live.
Yeah, lucky she can afford doing that. I cannot afford sleeping that much.
Yeah, I'm like, these cats are I'll be kicked out.
Yeah, I'll be kicked out of my chemical engineer school if I sleep that much. So.
Exactly. Yeah, we're like, cats, you have no idea the rent we pay for you to be able to sleep here. I love them. I love them so much.
I love cats too. Yeah.
Oh, I love it.
We work
it.
So hard to make our cats' lives better.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree.
Yeah.
So amen to that.
So all right. So if our listeners want to reach out to you, contact you, or do you want them to go through us, or are you willing to give any of your contact information?
Yeah, I mean, it's totally up to you guys. My name is Killian Colin, K-I-L-I-A-N. It's one L in Killian and one L in Colin, C-O-L-I-N. Mm-hmm. My Facebook page is public. My Twitter account is public. My Instagram is public. So they are more than welcome to follow me on social media. And if they want to reach out to you, they are more than welcome to get my information through you as well. So
we'll include it with the podcast.
Can we do one us? Is it okay if we post it on our?
Totally
page?
Okay. Totally fine. Totally fine. Yeah.
Awesome. And everyone listening, you can find us at thequeerarabs.com. We are on we have a Gmail, thequeerarabs@gmail.com. We have Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, The Queer Arabs.
Facebook being our main stomping ground.
Yeah, Facebook we're most active on, I would say, out of the social media. Also, it's extremely important for visibility's sake, and just for people to be able to find this podcast and for us to, you know, us to grow and for our guests to be heard. So rating and reviewing us on iTunes makes a huge difference. So please do so.
Like, share, subscribe. No, wait, that's YouTube. But like us on Facebook, share us on Facebook. Keep up with our webpage.
And subscribe on your podcast apps. There you
Wait,
go.
Wait, yeah, so it does work.
You can say that. We're on iTunes and all those other podcast apps like Stitcher, Google Play, all that fun
Spotify?
Stuff.
Spotify?
I don't know if we're on Spotify. I really need to find out. I need to check.
And just a side note for you
Overcast,
guys.
Yeah.
You have no idea how thankful I am to see openly LGBTQ Arab or Muslim, whatever you want to call yourself, talking about these important issues that nobody want to talk about.
Thank you.
So I'm forever grateful for you guys for giving us a platform to speak about our sexuality. It's unfortunately it's 2018 and still people think it's a taboo subject within our communities, but it is not, and. I just want our listener, if they were queer and Muslims or Arabs,
mm-hmm.
I just want them to know that they are not alone.
Yeah, you're not alone.
They are not alone.
We are here.
And please don't think of yourself as a disabled person or as a mistake. You are not a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
You are a diamond. You are
you
are different. That means you are special.
Right.
When you're different, you are special. Please hug yourself if nobody is hug you. Look in the mirror and say I love you.
Aww.
Because you are unique. You are beautiful. You are a diamond on this earth. When you are different, you are special. And not everybody is privileged enough to, you know, to be able to stand up. Because sometimes when you stand up and fight back, you lose maybe your life.
Yeah.
So I would say, don't feel ashamed of yourself if you couldn't do anything. Just love yourself, whoever you are, wherever you are.
Yeah.
And if you're going through a struggle, rest assured that is not your mistake. That's a society fault.
Yep, it is.
The society forced you into an arranged marriage. The society might force you into pretend that you're somebody else. I went to Tijuana, Mexico, last week to meet with the caravan migrants, refugees,
mm-hmm.
Who were denied the entry to the U.S. were denied asylum to the U.S. And I met with Stephanie. She's a transgender transgender woman from Honduras.
Mm-hmm.
She told me that she had to dress up like a man, and so she can go to work. How unfair that you have to live an identity that is not who you are. You know,
right.
Physically she was born in the wrong body, and and you know, going through the transitioning is a real struggle, and now she just have to go back and hide again her real self. When I look at Tiffany's story, I just started crying, you know, the persecution that she went through.
Wow.
They even cut people's fingers and heads, the gangs in Honduras, and the police doesn't help them at all, just yeah. because they were a transgender community. And you know, so this yeah. is the thing. I want you to know that this is not your mistake. This is not your fault.
No.
And you're not alone. You're not alone. You're
vulnerable.
We yeah. love you all. And you should before everybody else, you should love yourself.
Yes.
You know, you should love yourself. You're not a mistake. That's what I want people to hear. You're not a mistake. No matter who you are, no matter what person you want to be in bed with, no matter what body you want to be in, no matter what identity you want to have,
yeah.
You have every single right to do so.
Yep. You're beautiful.
You are beautiful. You're yeah. a diamond. That's how you should always look at yourself. You're a diamond.
So beautiful. Way to put it.
All right. So on that note, I'm Ellie.
I'm Alia, and
I'm Killian.
Thank you all so much for listening. This was a very meaningful episode.
And we are the Queer Air.